The late William S. Burroughs is a counterculture icon. His originality and vision stand out in the more than two dozen books he wrote, including the landmark novel Naked Lunch. In 1962, Norman Mailer described Burroughs as the only American writer living today who may be possessed by genius. William Burroughs was born 100 years ago today, and we have this appreciation from Tom Vitale in New York.
William Burroughs believed words took on new meaning if you could see them or hear them in a new way.
There's an occasional muffled report as blood vessels burst and sinuses exploded.
In 1959, Burroughs made these cut-up recordings, using reel-to-reel tape to record snippets of everything from readings to TV and radio clips, then rewinding, randomly stopping, and recording over the original sounds.
The total taste is here.
I am insured 22 and stolen horses in the hope that some of you will carry these experiments further.
It's the same technique Burroughs used in his masterpiece, the novel Naked Lunch. He shuffled the sections of the manuscript before submitting it to the publisher. The result was a story that jumps from scene to scene, idea to idea, narrator to narrator, in a random, disjointed manner. As Burroughs told me in 1987, in the apartment he called The Bunker on the Bowery, the idea for the cut-ups came from his friend and collaborator, the late avant-garde artist Brian Gysin.
He was, of course, the inventor of the cut-up method, which did introduce an element of chance into selection of material for writing. And, of course, then you realize that life is a cut-up. Every time you walk down the street or look out the window, your consciousness is being cut by these random factors. So it's really closer to the actual facts of perception.
Burroughs' perception while writing Naked Lunch was affected by heroin and withdrawal from it. In a commercial recording, he extrapolated the terror of that withdrawal into a vivid scene of horrible creatures drinking in a dark cafe.
Sucking translucent colored syrup through alabaster straws. Mugwumps have no liver and nourish themselves exclusively on sweets. Then purple-blue lips cover a razor-sharp beak of black bone, with which they frequently tear each other to shreds in fights over clients.
The vivid language and erotic these fantasies in Naked Lunch led to an obscenity trial, which the writer and publisher won. The central theme of much of what Burroughs wrote is the attempt of those in power to control those who aren't, says Barry Miles, author of the new 600-page biography, Call Me Burroughs.
I think his main role has been to look for control systems and be yourself, try and get beyond them and find out who you really are rather than who other people want you to be or what circumstances have made you. And in that, I think we need him more than ever, quite honestly, because the society becomes more and more a surveillance society and less of a democratic society.
Yet Burroughs came from society. He was named for his grandfather, the inventor of the adding machine, and founder of the Burroughs Corporation. He went to Harvard and studied English, but he had no intention of writing until he met 17-year-old poet Allen Ginsberg and 21-year-old novelist Jack Kerouac. They shared an apartment and what they called a new vision.
Artistically, we were doing completely different things. Comes down to the fact that we did have quite a lot in common, being interested in expanded awareness and being completely disillusioned with all the old answers.
It was the beginning of what became known as the Beat Generation, and among its circle, Burroughs found a soulmate. Joan Vollmer became his common-law wife for 6 years, even though he himself was gay. He preferred the word queer. By 1951, they were living in Mexico City when they found themselves at a party, drunk, says biographer Barry Miles.
It was during this party that at one point he just told Joan, let's do our William Tell act, and she put this shot glass on her head. And he whipped out his gun, and he missed, of course. He shot low and got her in the forehead. It was quite clearly an accident, but he felt that some bad part of him, some evil spirit in him, had motivated him.
In 1985, Burroughs told me he spent the rest of his life trying to write his way out of the death of Joan.
It was an event that made me see, or made me into a writer. And, of course, a writer, all his work will pivot around some central idea, like Poe, the fear of being buried alive, which happened in those days, that it was a sort of a pivotal event.
Before that, his writing was more or less straightforward autobiography, in such novels as Queer and Junkie. Afterwards, he began to write the denser, visionary prose of Naked Lunch, The Soft Machine, and Nova Express. Even his autobiographical characters, like Kim Carson's in the 1984 novel The Place of Dead Roads, became more fantastic.
Kim is a slimy, morbid youth of unwholesome proclivities, with an insatiable appetite for the extreme and the sensational. His mother had been into table tapping, and Kim adores ectoplasm, crystal balls, spirit guides, and auras. He wallows in abominations, unspeakable rites, diseased demon lovers.
Burroughs became a magnet for artists, musicians, and wannabe hipsters. But biographer Barry Miles says the writer's influence is yet to be completely understood.
The Beats have all died, all the major ones except Lawrence Ferlinghetti. And we're now starting to be able to see them from a distance and appreciate who was really important and who wasn't. And I think Burroughs is possibly now the lead contender of someone whose work is so deep and on so many levels that we've barely started to touch him, really.
In 1983, William S. Burroughs was elected to the American Academy and Institute of Arts and Letters. He died in 1997 at the age of 83. For NPR News, I'm Tom Vitale in New York.
Snow, rain, ice, and general gloom getting you down? Our book critic Maureen Corrigan recommends two novels, one new, one just published here in the U.S., that she says are fine literary antidotes to the winter blues.
In the opening paragraph of Moby Dick, Ishmael tells us he takes to sea whenever he feels the onset of a damp, drizzly November in his soul. I know how he feels. Whenever the frigid funk of February settles in, I too yearn to get out of town. This year I have, thanks to two exquisite vehicles of escape fiction. Rachel Paston's Elena and Catherine Pankole's The Yellow Eyes of Crocodiles are both smart entertainments, perfect for curling up with on a winter's night. Admittedly, they both fall into that much-disputed category of women's fiction. But I urge male readers not to feel automatically excluded, much as we women readers have learned to gamely step aboard boys-only clubs like that of, say, the Pequod. Speaking of Moby Dick and opening passages, Daphne du Maurier's 1938 novel Rebecca is a near rival to Melville's masterpiece when it comes to the fame of its first line. Last night I dreamt I went to Manderley again. You'll hear an echo of that line at the beginning of Rachel Paston's Elena, because Elena is an inspired reworking of du Maurier's Rebecca, which itself was an inspired reworking of Jane Eyre. As in Rebecca, our narrator here is unnamed, a sign of how little sense of self she possesses. Paston's narrator, who describes herself as a moth, works as a curator's assistant at a Midwestern art museum. Accompanying her odious boss to an art festival in Venice, she meets a tormented but charismatic gay man named Bernard Augustin, who's the founder of a renowned contemporary art museum on Cape Cod called the Nauk. Faster than you can say Maxim de Winter, the gloomy Bernard and our naive narrator bond platonically over cappuccinos, and he invites her to become the Nauk's new curator. That position is vacant because the former curator, a sleek, celebrated beauty named Elena, mysteriously vanished one night 2 years earlier into the dark waters off Cape Cod. Paston's Elena is so eerie and elegantly suspenseful that I could see myself rereading it the way I reread Rebecca every few years or so. One of Elena's distinctive pleasures is its deep familiarity with the contemporary art world, real and imagined. We hear, for instance, about extreme art exhibits where enormous collages of cotton and bone hang from the ceiling and dead sardines are nailed to gallery walls in great glittering waves of decay. The Nauk Museum itself is a brilliant riff on the Gothic mansions of yore, a modernist glass structure built into sand dunes. It conceals a labyrinth of cobwebby secrets and one vengeful female ghost bent on evicting our clueless narrator. The recently deceased Hollywood star Joan Fontaine played the mousy heroine in Hitchcock's film of Rebecca. I could see a modern-day Joan Fontaine type playing the heroine of The Yellow Eyes of Crocodiles, should a film version ever be made. Catherine Pancol's novel was an immediate bestseller when it was published some years ago in Europe, and it's easy to see why. This is a delicious French romp, replete with affairs and wit and screwball plot twists. The story centers on a shy scholar of the Middle Ages named Josephine, whose husband has deserted her and their two daughters in order to run off to Kenya with his sexy mistress, where he's managing a crocodile farm that supplies illegal skins to China. In order to make ends meet back in Paris, Josephine agrees to a scheme hatched by her wealthy but bored older sister. She, Josephine, will ghostwrite a medieval romance novel, while her glamorous sister will do the promotion and get the credit. Of course, the novel becomes a blockbuster. Ethical dilemmas ensue, more marriages fall apart, and more affairs are sparked. The delicious draw of The Yellow Eyes of Crocodiles is Josephine's transformation from field mouse to falcon. Not only does she eventually stand up to her domineering sister, but more dramatically, to her contemptuous teenage daughter, a girl, Josephine realizes, who has no use for love, tenderness, or generosity, who faces life with a knife between her teeth. Though they're very different in tone, both Elena and The Yellow Eyes of Crocodiles are escape fantasies about shy, bookwormy types triumphing over glossy power divas. I don't know about you, but that's a fantasy that pretty much always works for me.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Elena by Rachel Paston and The Yellow Eyes of Crocodiles by Catherine Pancol.
Rebecca Winter is at a crossroads. The famous photographer had been living off sales of one particular photograph for years. When it starts to dry up, she reluctantly decides to rent out her Manhattan apartment and move to a small rural town, far from her seemingly fabulous New York life. It is here that she tries to map out her next chapter. No longer married, no longer needed as much by her grown son, no longer as successful as she used to be. That's where we meet the main character in Anna Quinlan's newest novel. It is called Still Life with Breadcrumbs. Anna Quinlan joins us from our studios in New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Rachel.
When we think of a coming-of-age story, we tend to think of a teenager or maybe someone in their 20s, but this is its own kind of coming-of-age story, is it not?
Oh, my gosh. Can I crib that? That's fabulous.
Yes,
you're right.
Yes, you can.
It's a coming of second age, later age, something like that. And I'm really intrigued by the idea that we now live long enough to get to reinvent, rediscover ourselves over and over again. And that's definitely what's happening to Rebecca in this novel.
What is she looking for in this town? I mean, I've kind of mapped out what has driven her there, but what is she searching for?
Well, first of all, she's searching for new work. She's, as she keeps saying, a very intuitive photographer. And her wellspring of inspiration has dried up just a little bit, in part because her earlier photographs were so popular in ways that she can't quite apprehend and couldn't have predicted. And so she's looking for new work, but frankly, she's also in money trouble. As someone said to me, you know, you've really tapped the great taboo here. And I thought they meant sex. And in fact, they meant money or not having enough of it. And so one of the things that she's done is to leave New York, which is so fabulously expensive, behind to try to recoup financially in this town. It's not like she's dying to be there. It's in some ways a kind of a last resort for her.
And she's living in this very rustic cabin. Rustic is generous.
That's a nice way of putting it. Nothing works. There are
charming
no electrical outlets. I mean, she says early on she cannot believe that she, of all people, as a photographer, rented this place based on photographs. And she's really flummoxed by a lot of what goes on in the country. I mean, as you can see at the very beginning of the novel, she keeps hearing these noises above her bedroom, and it's not giving anything away to say that it's something that happens a fair amount in the country, which is that a raccoon has gotten into the attic crawl space. But for her, it might as well be a visitor from another planet.
So speaking of that raccoon in the attic, this is also just a flat-out love story. Can you tell us about Jim Bates?
Jim Bates is a roofer who comes to check out what someone calls the critter in the crawl space. And little by little, the two of them form a bond, not because they're the least bit alike, because they're not. They come from very different places. But because he needs somebody to take pictures and she needs work. And it's such a cliche, but the guy's salt of the earth. The guy's the kind of guy who doesn't let you make nasty remarks about somebody he likes, you know, who will take care of people who need taken care of. And she's never quite encountered anyone like him before.
There are some interesting themes in this book about the subjectivity of art. You know, you mentioned that Rebecca Winter is this famous photographer, and she kind of doesn't know why, but she became wildly famous for this one particular photograph. And then later people's tastes change and things change and she's not so famous and she's not so successful anymore. And when she's in this rural town, she starts just snapping photos of her dog and all of a sudden those are the next hottest thing. I wonder if that's something you intentionally set out to comment on.
Oh, I think about that all the time because that's a dangerous game of producing art, that especially in this information age, there's a sense that taste is not what you bring to the table. Taste is what other people tell you it is, whether they're critics or sales figures or the like. And I think that when you produce any kind of art, there has to be that moment when you know that it's good.
Rebecca's also just trying to figure out who she is, if she is not the Rebecca Winter, the acclaimed photographer. And I wonder if that is something you have ever had to grapple with personally. You have had this incredibly successful career as a writer. Have you ever worried that inspiration would dry up or taste would change and you would no longer be the Anna Quinlan?
Well, in 99.9% of my life, I'm not that person, really. One of my favorite moments in the novel is when Rebecca's getting out of a car and she says something about how she used to be Rebecca Winter, and Ben says to her, "You'll always be the Rebecca Winter."
Ben is her son.
Yeah, and what he means is that for him, and in an enduring way through her work, she's always going to be something special. But I think it's a mistake to get too attached to that kind of Macy's Thanksgiving Day parade balloon version of yourself, because it estranges you from other people. I mean, I've had the frequent experience of introducing myself to people who say, "Great, nice to meet you." And then every once in a while, I introduce myself to someone and they get this look on their face. My kids call it the Anna Quinlan look. And it means that they've read the work and they've liked it and they're shocked that it's embodied in a perfectly ordinary person. And I think the perfectly ordinary person thing is the thing that you always have to keep a hold of.
Anna Quinlan, her new novel is called Still Life with Breadcrumbs. She joined us from our studios in New York. Anna, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Rachel.
The online superstore Amazon got its start selling books, and it's been publishing books for a long time as well, romance, mystery, young adult. Up until now, though, it hadn't had its fingers in one of the biggest slices of the publishing pie, Christian books. That changed this past week. To get a sense of just how big this particular market is, we've reached Wynn Bassett. He's a writer and seminarian at the Yale Divinity School. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Rachel.
So clearly Amazon must see this as good business, getting into Christian publishing. How big is this market exactly?
Well, as of March 2013, the revenue of this business, and specifically Christian books, was $1.4 billion. It's a large industry, and all the big six publishing houses have their own Christian imprints. So I guess Amazon thought that it's about time that they get in the game too.
Amazon already publishes spiritual books, but that is different than Christian books, right? Can you explain the difference?
That's right. Amazon already has one imprint called Grand Harbor Press, and this imprint publishes self-help and spiritual books only. This new one that they announced last Thursday is going to be called Waterfall Press, and they specifically said they'll be publishing Christian fiction and nonfiction. And you asked what's the difference between spiritual books and Christian books. The word spiritual encompasses not only all religions, but also non-religions. Religion has connotations of perhaps doctrines and dogma, where spirituality can encompass anything from worshiping on Sundays to doing yoga on a Wednesday afternoon.
And the Christian books, as I understand it, what's really big, it's Christian fiction.
That's right. Waterfall Press said they'd be publishing Christian nonfiction and fiction, but fiction specifically has been taking off. Up until now, to find Christian fiction, you really have to go into the Christian bookstores. You're not likely to find a lot of Christian fiction in large brick-and-mortar stores like Barnes & Noble, for example. And Amazon already has a lot of Christian fiction books for sale, but now they'll be publishing their own. And it's, like I said, it's a popular industry right now, especially among the evangelical line.
I would just love if you could describe what Christian fiction means. How prevalent is a religious element in the storyline?
Christian fiction, to use an example that a lot of people might recognize, would be Flannery O'Connor, which one of the big publishing houses or one of their imprints, Farrar, Straus & Grobe, published our prayer journal recently and has done very well. So her short stories back in the mid-1900s were all Christian fiction. They did not whisper at all. There was evidence of priests and sacraments and taking the Eucharist, and they were very expressly Christian, as opposed to fiction without express Christian overtones, mm-hmm. who don't talk about church. But they still might display morals or ethics that you might find along Christian thinking.
Is it easier to sell Christian books that don't emphasize religion?
For mainstream and secular audiences, I think from my experience, they do well when they don't have the description Christian on them, because that brings a lot of meaning and connotations to that type of work. But within these independent Christian bookstores or these independent Christian publishers and imprints, the people buying these books like to see the word Christian on there, and I think that causes them to do extremely well.
Wynn Bassett, he is a seminarian at Yale Divinity School who follows the religious publishing industry. Thanks so much for talking with us, Wynn.
Thank you, Rachel.
What exactly do Muslim men want? That's the theme of a book of essays called Salam Love. The book grew out of a blog called Love Inshallah, which is a place where American Muslims turn for advice on love and sex, a place to share their personal experiences. We're joined now by Haroon Mogal, who wrote an essay included in the book. The essay is about growing up as an Indian Muslim kid in Massachusetts. He joins us now on the line. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So your essay is about high school, specifically the high school prom. Why is this the chapter of your life you wanted to use to illustrate your struggles with identity and romance in particular?
I think I've reached a point where I'm comfortable writing about certain things in my life, so long as a decade and a half has passed. So I decided there was sufficient distance that I could tackle topics that might be a little bit taboo within some Muslim circles, but I didn't want to get too personal, shall we say.
So you were a pretty regular American teenager growing up in a Massachusetts town. But there were all these things, these regular American things you couldn't do. I'd love if you could read just from the very first page of the essay.
Sure. I tried to go along. I bought into it. We didn't drink. They did. We didn't dance. They did. We didn't date. They did. We did not like girls, never mind need them. Somehow it was assumed but unspoken that a spouse would pop up in a kind of ironclad Pakistani-American Hegelianism. Thesis, antithesis, children. But there was only so long I could stand being on the sidelines.
And how did your parents address these issues with you?
By not addressing them. That was their approach. I don't even know if they ever actually explicitly told me that at some point I would be allowed to get married. I think it was sort of assumed that after I did med school and residency and a fellowship, then somehow I would get married. To who and how and what I would think about that, no idea, except probably by the age of 35, which, to note, I am still not at.
You write in the essay that you were the only kid who wasn't allowed to go to sex ed class. How come?
We don't talk about those things. As a result, we have the highest growth rates in the world. There's some sort of, you know, paradoxical relationship here.
But you would think that since your parents weren't comfortable talking about it, it would be easy to outsource the conversation to school.
It was just not discussed. The only way I found out was that I was told I had to go to the library one day. And I was sort of like, why? You know, I mean, usually if you're in trouble, you don't go to the library. And then I found out from my classmates that everyone is taking these sex ed classes for a couple weeks. And they told me that, yeah, a letter was sent home to our parents and they signed off on it. And so it was pretty devastating to be the only brown kid and the only Muslim kid and the new kid and the only one who's not allowed to take sex education. Kind of marks you for life.
You also weren't allowed to go to your prom, mm-hmm. But you decided that it was a rule that you were going to break. Why was it so important to you at the time?
I think for me in senior year, I started to finally feel comfortable in my own skin. And to me, prom was the culmination of everything, right? It was the one thing that you did that marked you in high school. And for me, it was like a challenge I set to myself, something I wanted to do, something I felt I had to do, and then eventually something I thought would help me understand myself a little bit better.
Hmm. So why this book? What's important about it? Why is it something you wanted to be a part of?
I think for a lot of American Muslims, especially those of us who are in some kind of community role, we were forced to become, for lack of a better term, professional Muslims. A lot of the things that I wanted to do with my life, I was unable to do because I realized that as an American and as a Muslim, I had an obligation to become part of a conversation that we as a country needed. And I don't regret that. And I think it was something that is the right thing to do. But unfortunately, I think in the process, we were forced to deny a lot of parts of ourselves. And I don't think the Muslim community would have been ready to receive a book like this 10 or 15 years ago. I think it just came around at a point where I felt like I had to say something and get it off my chest and not pretend to be just one kind of person.
Haroon, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Haroon Mogul is the author of an essay in the book Salaam Love, American Muslim Men on Love, Sex, and Intimacy. It has 22 very different essays from American Muslim Men. The book comes out Tuesday.